We need your help to keep the Rufus Project and all its episodes online. Unfortunately, we're getting very close to the limit of our free hosting and will shortly need to start paying. How can you help, I hear you ask? So glad you did ask. You can head to our homepage at therufusproject.podomatic.com and hit that donate button to throw an extra few coins our way. Alternatively, if you have a product or service that you feel would be of interest to the Rufus Project listeners, then please get in touch with us at rufusreviews@gmail.com. Thanks so much. Now on with the show. Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project. I'm your host, Trevor Holland, and a bit later on you'll also be hearing from my good friend, Christian Fletcher. And what a great show we have in store for you. First up, we're going to be visiting some of the more interesting stories in the geek news, and then we're going to have a look at Supergiant's latest epic, Transistor. Christian will then be joining us, talking about the upcoming 30th anniversary of The Neverending Story and some of the other classic kids' movies of that era. I've got a review of Edge of Tomorrow, but then we're going to go back to the kids' movies for our redeeming feature section. Now, we don't have an interview this time around, but we have made up for that by the fact that the redeeming feature section this time around is pretty damn epic. We'll then, of course, have a look at some of the upcoming events around Brisbane and give you the details of our exciting new competition. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. And now it's time to look at the geek news headlines that have been catching our attention over the past fortnight. A government review into spending for the ABC network and SBS has come up with a suggestion that their online players, being iView and SBS Catch Up TV, should offer premium paid-for versions. So for instance, ABC iView, which offers a variety of catch-up shows, could then have a premium service which had archives of, say, full series and offer streaming in higher definition. For once, I've got to say, I'm not totally in opposition to what the government has suggested. If the price was reasonable, it's certainly something that I would consider. What are your thoughts? Guillermo del Toro came out with the news also that Pacific Rim will be getting a sequel coming in 2017. But not only are we going to see more gigantic fighting mech shenanigans on the big screen, we're also getting an animated series in the lead up to it. I am a fan of the first Pacific Rim, so I'm pretty excited for number two. Both Foxtel and QuickFlix came through with some Chromecast news for Australian users of that very nifty gadget. If you didn't hear my review last podcast, have a listen to it. I definitely suggest you get one of these things. So Foxtel is going to offer its Presto service with Chromecast compatibility, and QuickFlix obviously is going to offer its streaming content with Chromecast options. Wish I could be more excited about this, but considering Presto is overpriced and is pretty bad quality, and QuickFlix just doesn't have the streaming archive to make it interesting for the price that they're charging, I'm still waiting for iView's Chromecast update to really get my Aussie TV fix going. Now, us Aussies may not be able to show the world just how much we enjoy downloading Game of Thrones now that the current series has finished, but we can still show the world how much we like lining up for Game of Thrones. The Game of Thrones exhibition in Sydney has an average wait time of 4 hours if you're queuing up to visit. I'm not that keen. And to round things out, the lovely argument that's been developing between iNet's Chief Regulatory Officer Steve Dolby and Village Roadshow CEO Graham Burke is still going strong. Steve responded to Graham's accusations of iNet lying to the Australian public because iNet was profiting from all these people downloading all this stuff on the internet illegally. And Steve's response was, well, you know, the more people download, the more expensive it is for us to offer them our service. And that he doesn't condone piracy on the iNet servers because that means they make less money from their customers. Graham Burke's response the very next day, Steve's still lying. In that same interview where Graham Burke completely ignored Steve Dolby's perfectly logical response, he also touted out that, yes, talks had been going with Netflix, and Netflix was coming to Australia soon. Unfortunately for Graham, the complete Burke, Netflix came out the very next day to say, no, we're still not planning to come to Australia. We're actually focusing on non-English speaking countries in Europe as our top priority. I'm really wondering how much longer it's going to be before somebody from the Entertainment Consortium, the right holders lobby, taps Graham Burke on the shoulder and just says, will you shut up? I know that's what I want to say to him every time I read about one of his rants.
I always thought it's hard to make new friends, but making enemies, I guess that's easy.
Transistor, the latest game by Supergiant Games, who you may remember from the indie classic Bastion, is another entry in the stylish, arty, and musical indie game genre. In Transistor, you play the role of Red, a red-headed singer who has mysteriously lost her voice and has teamed up with the Transistor, a glowing talking sword. And it's the Transistor that provides the narration and guidance throughout the game.
We got four problems. We saw their faces. We know their names.
As you explore the isometric world, details of the events that caused Red to lose her voice and team up with the Transistor are revealed bit by bit, with many a fight scene along the way. So what can you expect from Transistor? Well, it's certainly a game that throws you straight in. The opening scene is basically Red having to pull the Transistor, the sword, out of a guy's chest. No explanation why, it just has to happen. You then set off to explore a visually gorgeous isometric world. This game has been made with the PS4 and the PC in mind, so the visuals are indeed very tasty. Not only is Transistor a treat for the eyes, it's also a pretty nice treat for the ears. The music in this game is haunting and quite impressive. The composer, Darren Korb, already showed that he could do some very impressive audio when it came to Supermassive Games' previous game, Bastion, and he teams up with Ashley Barrett, who provides some very haunting vocals. Look, normally I can take or leave game soundtracks, but this one is particularly impressive, and luckily you can listen to the entire thing on YouTube, and that's officially, by the way, but of course, looking awesome and sounding great isn't really that important if the game plays like a brick on the end of a bit of string. The animation and the transition between areas is quite smooth, and while there is plenty of exploration and little bits and pieces teaching you about the world and the plot, these are all really just the filling between the actual action scenes within the game. You regularly combat increasingly difficult robot hordes. Red has a number of moves at her disposal, and they can be upgraded in a myriad of ways, so it does give you some variety in your playstyle, and you can customize it to suit your own preferences quite easily. You do have the option to just hack away, but where the combat really shines is that with a quick flick of a button, you enter a planning mode, where you have a power bar which depletes as you plan where Red is going to move and what attacks she's going to use. Once you've got it all planned out, hit the action button, and watch your plan unfold. It's not all guaranteed though, because those robots are still moving around. So you may have planned a great attack which you thought was going to get four of the suckers, but hey, two of them moved. So you only knocked two out, and you've got two more that are going to come after you during the brief recovery moment, when you're basically completely helpless. If they get you and you end up dying, it's not game over. What the game does instead is temporarily disables whichever move you are using the most. This is rather clever because it does force you to think of new strategies and experiment more with the remaining moves you have available. So it really does help you understand a pretty complex combat system without the need of a lengthy, boring tutorial. Of course, there's also the big boss fights, which unlock some pretty major abilities to add into the mix, and defeating the bosses provides the more crucial info as to finding out just what the heck is going on. There are a few interesting side things you can do. For instance, there's actually a hum button. By pressing it, the background music will mute a little bit, and Red will actually hum along with whatever is playing in the background. It's completely pointless, but damn if it isn't entertaining, and a nice way to take a little break in the game. Another pointless feature, on the PS4 version at least, is also how the light bar on the PlayStation 4 controller flashes in time, with the transistor having a chat. There is no reason for it, but it just adds a little something extra. I did find that playing Transistor for an extended period of time did get a little, well, tedious. However, its pick-up-and-play nature means that you can complete it in shorter bursts over a longer period of time. Despite that, the plot still remains compelling, and dropping back into the lush, visual, and wonderfully sounding world of Transistor is always a pleasure after a little break. If Transistor was a full-priced game, I probably wouldn't recommend it quite as much, but since you can pick it up for about $20, it's certainly worth a look.
They'll find you and finish the job. Unless you find them first.
I was really happy recently to be able to acquire the screening rights to bring Neverending Story back to the big screen for one night only for the 30th anniversary. Hard to believe it's been that many years. I do remember seeing it as a child and being a bit frightened by it, to be honest. Funny story, I remember watching a Mickey Mouse cartoon when I was a kid, probably about 4 or 5, and I was quite interested to see what was on the other channel, and believe it or not, it was the Neverending Story. My first glimpse of a guy riding a snail, and I was quick under the covers and didn't want to watch any more. Straight back to the Mickey Mouse cartoon. You can look back on these movies and go, wow, it definitely impacted me as a child, and might not have been as scary as I first remembered. There's something about these 80s movies that have a real innocence about them, especially if you're watching them now. It's funny seeing, example, in a movie like Labyrinth, seeing Jennifer Connelly standing in front of a green screen that is so obviously green screen, but it does just have that innocence about it, almost naivety. And any special effects were actually special. They weren't pure CGI, which a lot of the children today are being conditioned to.
But that's impossible!
They had to work with what was available. Neverending Story from 1984 is one that stands up quite remarkably well. A lot of people say they do look back and go, oh, it wasn't as great as they remember as a kid, but hey, aren't most movies like that? Originally released as a German and US production, it was based on the book by Michael End, who actually fought to have his name removed from the film when he saw that only half his book had been adapted. I have read the book, it is about 400 pages. I believe the movie only deals with the first 100. These things do happen with movie adaptations, so he did fight to have his name removed from the credits and have the name of the show completely renamed. So, and he would have hated number 2 and number 3 then, for sure. Now, it's funny, whenever I screen it, and you can watch it now with audiences, and there's a few chuckles from them, especially the sexual innuendo between Bastian and Falcor. Most of the Fantasia scenes were filmed in Germany, and any scenes with Bastian in the bookshop were made in the USA. How could we mention Neverending Story without mention of Lamar's hit song, The Neverending Story, which became a top hit all around the world, and unfortunately introduced us to him. Also celebrating its 30th anniversary this year is Gremlins, which was directed by Joe Dante, who had a career as very much an independent filmmaker and really hit the big time around this period. It was probably the first sort of family film to bring a bit of macabre and a bit of horror to it, rather than these straight fantasy films, which most family movies were, you know, pure escapism. Around that time too, we had, you know, probably the first movie that I ever remember seeing at the cinema, which was Flight of the Navigator from 1986, which stars a young Sarah Jessica Parker. This was, I remember being so overwhelmed seeing that on the big screen, and I remember being almost scared, and then you look back at it now and you know, there's nothing scary about that film at all. But then going the other angle, more a family, a bit more an adult teenage type film, you have Princess Bride from 1986, directed by Rob Reiner, which you will see we have coming up soon at the Globe Theatre on the 3rd of August, so why not get a chance to revisit that or experiencing it for the first time. So we have mentioned a few different titles here, but Neverending Story seems to be the one that people speak most fondly of, and it's definitely probably the most mainstream and the most well known.
For anyone who's ever made a wish, believed in a fantasy, or had a dream, this is The Neverending Story.
What I am about to tell you sounds crazy, but you have to listen to me. Your very lives depend on it.
Edge of Tomorrow is a sci-fi action flick where the world is struggling in their battle against an alien menace threatening to wipe out humanity. Into this picture steps Major William Cage, played by Tom Cruise, whose role is pretty much press handling and propaganda. That is until a fall from grace sees him on the front line in the final battle to win back the Earth for humanity.
I'm not a soldier.
Seeing that he's never seen combat before, the battle doesn't go too well for him, and he dies quite nastily on the battlefield. Much to his surprise, he then wakes up at the start of the day beforehand, with full memory of what's happened to him. This starts a cycle of him repeating the same day over and over again. He enlists the help of Rita Ratasky, played by Emily Blunt, who actually knows something about what is happening to him, and together they must work out a way to stop the alien menace once and for all.
You're a weapon.
So is this just another science fiction action Tom Cruise saves the world movie? Or does it have that edge to take it to the next level? Edge of Tomorrow is actually adapted from a Japanese novel called All You Need Is Kill by Hiroshi Sekurazaka, and it does bring quite a fresh take on the science fiction alien invasion action genre. This is certainly helped along by the two main stars. This is probably one of Tom Cruise's best performances in quite some time. Starting as the completely out of his depth Major William Cage, we get to see Tom start from cowardly panic through to determined, battle-hardened action hero. And along the way, he also manages to give us quite a few laughs in what is not the lightest of movies. Emily Blunt, as Sergeant Rita Ratasky, also shines. She provides a great counterpoint to Tom Cruise's character, and has to balance out the fact that she does know what is happening with the fact that every time Tom Cruise turns up to meet her, she needs to act like it's the first time that she's seen him.
I need your help.
With what exactly?
Winning the war.
She also makes for a fine action hero, and it's great to see Emily in such a strong role. The rest of the characters are basically cliched fillers, there to provide, I guess, a bit of a springboard to help push events along. You've got your strict drill sergeant, the tough Aussie, the serious dry British general, the list goes on. But luckily, even though they are cliched, all the actors do a great job in portraying them, and it certainly does not detract from the movie in any way. But where would a sci-fi action blockbuster be without the CGI alien menace? The Mimics, who come to Earth via a handy asteroid strike, are certainly spectacular beasties. Super fast, with lots of flailing limbs, there's no doubt that these things are as menacing as they are alien. The CGI works pretty well, and blends nicely with the live action happening all around it. Meaning that even during the most spectacular of action sequences, you don't get taken out of the movie by some glaring discrepancy between the computer-generated stuff and the real-life actors. JJ, I hope you're taking note. So to sum up, I pretty much have to take a line from other reviews I've heard. I don't feel so bad though, because I've heard the same line from at least three or four different reviewers. Edge of Tomorrow is pretty much the love child of Groundhog Day and Starship Troopers. And there's no doubt that those two movies had a damn fine baby. Go see this one.
What day is it?
Judgment Day.
Boy? Oh boy.
When the world's greatest athlete, Michael Jordan, teams up with the world's best-loved cartoon character, Bugs Bunny, you won't believe your eyes.
Welcome to this week's Redeeming Features, and as a special treat, we've got Christian on the other end of the line again, so we can both have a chat about a slightly better movie than last time. And I do apologize if you did watch Blood Rain after our little chat about it. I am deeply, deeply sorry. So, Christian, how are you today?
Great, thank you, Trevor. I actually didn't get subjected to Blood Rain yet. It's on my list, but from the sounds of it, I've been given warning against it.
Honestly, I feel bad for even suggesting people watch that movie, so feel free to take it off your list.
For sure. Maybe spell it R-A-I-N and then you might get a totally different movie, possibly a better movie than Blood, R-A-Y-N-E.
Quite possibly. But we're kind of going the opposite end of the spectrum. From hyper-violent, super gory, horror, vampire, whatever it was flick, this podcast, we're going to visit the heady days of the 90s and the rather interesting Looney Tunes basketball crossover Space Jam.
Good old Space Jam from 1996, which is quite interesting. I thought it came out a little bit earlier than that, but I was quite surprised. Definitely not a film that was normally at the bottom of the barrel, but definitely one to explore again. I missed it the first time around, so being able to watch it for this podcast was a bit of a thrill to actually see how the plot turned out, because I think from all I knew was they melded Michael Jordan basketball and the Looney Tunes together, very much in a Who Framed Roger Rabbit style, but probably not quite as classic. So it was really interesting to see how this played out, because there was a bit of a craze in the mid-90s for basketball. I remember when I was around that age, when every second boy was wearing a Chicago Bulls cap. So I can understand why this movie was made, and it was a real it was a really big thing at the time. And it was a thing too. I know in 1997, the following year, Shaquille O'Neal did Kazam, which was him as Genie. So I think they went through a bit of a phase in the mid-90s where they tried to do the basketball player to movie crossover. And I'd say Space Jam was the most successful of those. Michael Jordan as an actor, though, I was happy to see him not actually playing a character. A lot of times when a sports player or someone who's not known as being a movie star tries to do a movie, they try to act, and that's usually the biggest problem. And it was great that they were able to have Michael Jordan as himself.
With all the basketballers, there were quite a few that turned up there. I mean, Charles Barkley is another well-known name from there. And the other ones, I'm afraid I'm not much of an expert on 90s.
Yeah, I'm not too sure. They 90s kind of slip by, especially when you've got the credits opening with Michael Jordan and Bugs Bunny as the stars, you kind of do forget the other names.
Some other appearances in there which kind of push others into the background, but we can talk about that a little bit later.
Well, I'm actually going to, right off the bat, mention the opening. I personally felt that with the film, film opens in 1973 when Michael Jordan's a young boy and he's saying to his father how he wants to go on and be a basketball player. And I actually found this scene kind of irrelevant, because it then goes into, Trevor's favourite section, I believe, which is possibly the opening credits of the film, which you might want to explain for us.
The big famous song from this movie, of course, was I Believe I Can Fly, which still gets sung by my children today, even though they actually haven't seen Space Jam, and I'm arguing whether or not to let them. But after a brief bit of that, it launches into this extended montage of Michael Jordan shooting hoops and doing the, catching air and slam dunking, all against this, you can only call it a 90s movie theme song, with the starting to hear that trace of electro, and you've got the overdone rap and the soulful female coming in singing about the Space Jam in the chorus.
And what about the cheers from the crowd as he's going through in this montage, which really makes you think, was it really necessary for the, what did we clock up, almost 6 minutes, I believe it might have been?
Something like, it felt longer.
I actually checked it earlier, and when I was looking around the 5 minute mark, I'm like, wow. It was actually, it did feel like a lot longer than that, but it definitely, like, just coming back to even that song, the whole soundtrack, it felt so much like the 90s, where they brought in a lot of those very rapper type songs, but then there's occasionally songs on the soundtrack like That's the Way I Like It by KC and the Sunshine Band, kind of like what Super Mario Brothers were trying to do with Walk the Dinosaur, bring that song out to a new generation, but maybe kind of missing the mark a bit.
just a little, but hey, I meant to be redeeming, so I will tell you,
shouldn't praise it too much.
If you are a big basketball fan, especially from the Jordan era, then you probably will love the opening montage, because it basically is a Jordan commercial.
And as I mentioned earlier, Michael Jordan is quite likable and doesn't try to play to play someone who he's not. So he's appealing very much to his core audience. So as you said, if you're a basketball fan, you'd love this. But I think the thing that would appeal to me when I was younger and still does now is definitely the animation or the Looney Tunes side, because that's something I can relate to, not being a basketball fan. And the animation was quite good for its time. It cleverly melded, like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, especially the earlier scenes where they went from, on Earth to up in the animated aliens and straight back down again. It was very clever, and the animation almost felt a lot more fuller than, say, watching the Looney Tunes cartoons on TV. I don't know, I got that feel about it too. So yeah. Definitely the animation is a big part about it. And you know, just being able to see what they can do in a studio, which, you know, in 1996 was still a big deal to have stuff like that happening. So
Certainly, that was one thing I noticed, was it was the combination of the live action, the more traditional animation for the Looney Tunes, obviously a bit more detail for the big screen, and then you've got this 90s CGI. It doesn't hold up all that well today, but the blend, the fact that they are blending those three things in this movie in 96 is quite impressive.
Oh, definitely. And it would have been amazing to see on the big screen. Did you miss it the first time around? You never saw it at the cinema?
I must admit I did. I wasn't much of a baller
at
the time, so I managed to bypass this one.
Yeah, well, I do remember it being a big deal when it came out, and my research has shown that it actually did quite well financially. Like, it wasn't a box office bomb. It set out to do exactly what it did, which is pretty much a commercial for, well, I believe it, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but it actually was a bit of a biographical sort of film about Michael Jordan's first retirement from basketball and then going back into it, hence the reason why in this film, you know, the Looney Tunes are trying to bring him back in and you know, and how they create the plot. It's funny when you think about, aside from the human actors, that Michael Jordan would have spent probably 90% of that shoot on a green screen.
Yeah.
And he does very well with it.
It is impressive. One of the first things I thought, though, is when they went down into the earth and you saw the big Looney Tunes logo and you go through it, it's like, oh, look, after Toontown was almost destroyed and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, they went underground.
Oh, so true. And that's so funny, too. And the funny thing is, like, you've got the Warner Brothers logo. I think later on Daffy Duck has it, like, tattooed on his ass.
Yes.
Or something like that. And it felt so much like, yeah, this might be a big advertisement for a basketball player, but this is a big advertisement for Warner Brothers as well. And it's funny, like, I'm trying to think of around the time, but I wonder if there was a reason why they chose the Looney Tunes characters. I know Warner Brothers possibly, you know, having come up with the idea, but I'm interested to know why the Looney Tunes characters were chosen in the mid-90s, when to me they probably weren't as huge as they'd been in the yesteryear. I don't know. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that this was made, obviously, at the height of the basketball craze in the 90s. So by rolling in the Looney Tunes characters, they were hoping that was going to work both ways. You know, get the basketball guys out to a wider audience and actually have the ballers themselves in there. But at the same time, get some of these kids that are wholly into sport and see if you can persuade them to head back to the Looney Tunes.
Yeah, good point. And it's definitely great for, like, I believe from memory, it was on in the school holidays, you know, in 1996 when it came out here. It's really appealing to so many different people. So I think it possibly was Warner Brothers being very, very clever.
But I'll tell you what, though, I mean, you mentioned Daffy Duck before, but I did find that some of the gags in there were probably aimed a bit higher than what was probably the target audience. I mean, you had Daffy Duck kissing his own ass with the Warner Brothers logo.
Yeah.
I mean, and also the main bad guy of the piece just smoking on that cigar. It's not something you would see at all.
Which I believe was voiced by Danny DeVito, actually, too. So it took a while to sort of, before we realised that that's who it was, playing that character, the lead alien or whatever his name is. I remember in particular, there's one part where they're talking about all the different things, and it's weird hearing Sylvester the cat go, "We've got balls!" You know, just all this little innuendo and stuff like that, and it's really taking it to, it's a bit step higher. So maybe it was appealing more to the teenage basketballers than the under 10 kids.
But then, sorry for the spoiler here, but there's actually a number of basketballers that appear, and they have their talent stolen by these aliens so that they can win this basketball game that they're all ending up to. And all these basketballers go for this treatment, and probably one of the most genuine reactions in there is when one of them's lying down on a psychiatrist's couch, and the psychiatrist asks, "So are you having any trouble performing in any other areas?" And it's like, did they just drop an impotency gag in a bloody kids movie?
But they then even stop. He even then stops and looks at the camera and go, as if to go, "No, there's nothing wrong." And it was so tongue in cheek, and it's so new that it knew what it was trying to do, which is quite interesting. So maybe it was trying to get a bit more of a mature audience, or definitely have something of appeal to the parents. But not being someone who watches a lot of the Pixar movies, but do you find that those sort of films nowadays use a lot of innuendo?
You find some of the ones that, not so much the Pixar ones, they're pretty good at rolling in something for everyone without going the nod, nod, wink, wink angle. But some of the, I suppose, cheaper productions, some of the ones which I guess have a bit more of a rushed schedule and just get out there to try to piggyback on some of the more successful movies, you'll often find that they will still throw in stuff which is just like, hang on, this is a kid's movie, guys.
Yeah, and it kind of makes you go, ooh, that didn't sit right. You know, so that those movies are probably always going to be a little bit on the edge anyway. But it was actually interesting. I was quite surprised to see Bill Murray in there too in Space Jam. But but seeing the Ivan Reitman who actually produced it and seeing the connection there, and it was funny seeing Bill Murray sort of do a bit of a spoof of Caddyshack and Ghostbusters. I believe at one stage he turns his cap over and goes, "We mean business," or some line from Ghostbusters, and made me go, "Ah, that's it."
Well, look, definitely Bill Murray with his self-referential humor and his desperation to become a basketballer.
Done.
Yeah.
You kick it in here.
You go to the hole and dominate.
We on defense.
Oh, yeah.
Whoa. I don't play defense.
And if you're aware of Bill Murray's stature, it's never going to happen. But he was truly one of the highlights. And then he comes to the rescue just out of nowhere towards the end of the movie when it looks like they're going to have to forfeit because they don't have enough people playing. And suddenly Bill Murray's there.
Yeah, but it was almost like, too, he's like, yeah, I kind of like this movie. Give me a bit of a bigger part now. Because he always almost expected it to be like a cameo type thing, but he was in it quite a lot. But he even makes, you know, reference to the fact that he knows the producer. I think at one stage Michael Jordan goes, oh, why are you here? And he goes, oh, I know the producer. But it was so true. So very much, as you said, very self-referential jokes. And it also felt the movie had a lot of in-jokes too, not just about the about basketball, but, you know, the characters involved. So, you know, especially the actor whose name I don't know, but he seems to be in every second 90s movie.
Actually, yeah, it was Wayne Knight, Stan, the guy that wants to help out Michael Jordan all the time.
That's right, Wayne Knight, that's it. I would have said something totally different.
He is in so many 90s movies. He turned up and just went, oh, it's the bad guy from Jurassic Park. Oh, no, he just turns up so much in these things.
Almost to the fact, I think if he wasn't in a 90s movie, he'd go, oh, I'd take it back to the video shop and go, I think you gave me the wrong movie.
Something's missing.
Yeah, so definitely, well, we have given some redeeming features with the fact of the cameos, and it's funny, you know, and also it's trying to spot some of the vocal talent. I didn't look into it too much, but aside from Danny DeVito, I believe that was the only famous vocal actor in that, and apparently Mel Blanc, who created Looney Tunes, had died not long before the film, so all the Looney Tunes characters were redubbed. But I found that, you know, Bugs Bunny and a lot of the characters sounded very spot on, so they did a good job.
Yeah, pretty much. But I mean, talking about the Looney Tunes characters, and again, sorry for the spoiler, but
it's
Yosemite Sam, Yosemite Sam, and Alma Fudd, the Pulp Fiction gag.
Oh yes.
I actually was watching this on the train, and it was all I could do just not to burst out laughing. It was perfect.
Oh, definitely. And it timed so well in terms of the fact that this was just after the Academy Awards, when Pulp Fiction had sweeped it and become this big independent thing, and you know, a couple of years after the fact, it's got this cult around it. So that's another one of those very tongue-in-cheek referential gags, and trying to get also different people, different demographics as well, like appealing to totally different people. I think there was a couple of other references to movies too, sorry.
Yeah.
I can't think offhand, but I remember going, oh, wow, that's funny.
I know. And again, definitely a gag that the younger audience you think this movie would be aimed for would not be getting.
Oh, for sure, you know, and it's definitely interesting, and it packed more of a punch than I thought it would, with having the, you know, having a lot of these these in jokes and having these other actors. So it definitely exceeded my expectations, and they managed to bring in a new character too, Bugs Bunny's love interest, Lola Bunny, which I'd seen at Movie World and gone, where does she fit in? Mm. And that's interesting to know that she's now a character because of Space Jam.
Mind you, some of the sexuality around that character was a bit excessive, I think. Again, for the movie, for that thing.
And especially when at the start she kept making a huge point of going, don't call me doll, you know, almost like they were trying to, you know, making sure, oh, we better make sure the female love interest, dare I say it, considering she's a rabbit, dare I say, she can't dare be, seen as not strong or or submissive or something like that. So I thought that was quite funny as well too. So, but she definitely had her own identity, but she really was just Bugs Bunny painted a different color.
Pretty much. Well, I suppose it was a better option than having a double of Bugs Bunny dressing in drag like he does in the old Looney Tunes.
Oh, I know. And that's the thing, like, you know, having grown up and watched a lot of Looney Tunes, from memory, I I couldn't remember a lot of their personalities, but Space Jam was a good way for you to sort of remember, you know, sort of what, you know, Pepe Le Pew and a lot of these characters that you sort of, you know, you see at Movie World or you see and, you know, pictures of, but you don't normally get to see their characters in action. So that's another good reason what Space Jam is. It's introducing them to a new audience.
I know I mentioned that, you know, if you are a big basketball fan, then you are going to get treats by some of the action in this. But if you're not so much keen on the American ballers of the 90s, there is also plenty of footage of sad basketballers trying to get help. And this is stilted acting, and they kind of just stand there in the middle of the court, just sort of like quivering slightly and looking sad. Considering how much colour and action and movement the rest of the movie has, it's quite jarring and high-energy movie. And then you got these guys that you know are professional athletes just trying to fake that they have no skills, and while being strangely entertaining, is certainly not convincing.
Really trying to dumb them down, almost just to show, hey, the stars of this are the Looney Tunes and Michael Jordan, you guys are just in the background, yet they still have them in there because, you know, it's a basketball movie. So yeah, maybe it was the writers trying to push them a bit more and make them actually try and act, which, as I mentioned earlier, is not necessarily a good thing with a sports player. But hey, a couple of them have made the move over to movies, but possibly not Michael Jordan. I think he was best sticking with what he did.
Definitely. Well, I mean, really, at the end of the day, Space Jam, I've got to say, was an enjoyable watch, and I was very surprised by it. So normally, I guess when we do these redeeming features, it's more about just things we found funny or just plain bizarre about films. But this is one that I'm actually happy to say that I feel has sufficient redeeming features to make it worth a watch. And as we mentioned, there's quite a bit in there for pretty much everyone, from kids to adults.
Definitely. And if you missed it the first time around, or if you saw it and want to revisit it again, I definitely recommend it. And just to be able to, you know, to say you've seen it, and very representative of a particular point in time, which, you know, most movies are, especially of a time when basketball was so damn huge, and at a, you know, a possibly a movie studio that was trying to crack into a new market, and at a basketball player that was trying to crack into a totally different audience as well. So yeah, very very much of its time, and worth a look.
Excellent. So if you do end up watching Space Jam after listening to this, please let us know what you thought of it. And of course, as always, let us know what you thought of us for convincing you to watch it.
That's always good. Good feedback's always good.
Yes, please, feedback. We love it. Okay, well, thanks, Christian. That was a great conversation about Space Jam.
Yes, thanks so much, Trevor. I look forward to possibly a bad movie next time. Well, interesting to see what we come up with next.
Well, we could always go to the fact that if we follow a theme, we talked about basketballers as actors. There's also a number of movies out there where they try to make wrestlers actors.
Oh, for sure. Oh, that's probably two podcasts there, or a whole podcast just on the redeeming features. So but we'll have to add it to the list.
I think so, definitely. And definitely, look, if you have anything that you want to challenge us to find redeeming features of, then, again, drop us a line. We're certainly happy to get the suggestions.
Fantastic. Thanks, Trevor.
Thank you, Christian.
Pardon me, Mr. Jordan. Could I have your your John Hancock?
What's going on here?
We need your help!
In the world of Christian Fletcher, there's always many events coming up, and it's really exciting to announce this July we have a very extensive program happening at the New Globe Theatre, 220 Brunswick Street, Fortitude Valley. We head to Japan this Sunday with the screening of Kill Bill at 6 p.m, and then following on the 9th of July we have The Crow, which starts at 6:30 p.m. Forget the state of origin, let's revisit the 1994 cult classic on the big screen. If French is more your kind of thing, we have Amelie on Sunday the 13th of July, which is in commemoration of Bastille Day. As mentioned early in the podcast, we are revisiting The Neverending Story for the 30th anniversary on Wednesday the 16th of July. This kicks off at 6:30 p.m, but if 80s kids classics aren't necessarily your thing, and you'd rather a bit of horror, why not consider catching the Queensland premiere of the Rob Zombie film Lords of Salem, which is taking place on Thursday the 17th of July at 6:30 p.m. How about striking a pose and rubbing shoulders with Ben Stiller and a host of other people like Will Ferrell and David Bowie, with a screening of Zoolander on Sunday the 20th of July at 7 p.m. Get there early, have a few drinks, and enjoy a cult classic on the big screen. A more contemporary cult classic too. Any David Lynch fans out there? Fans of late 70s trash, experimental cinema? Why not head to David Lynch's Eraserhead, screening Wednesday the 23rd of July at 6:30 p.m. With news of the recent Monty Python reunion, why not revisit one of their classic films, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, one of my personal favourites, which is screening for its 40th anniversary on Wednesday the 30th of July. For nights that say knee, and for only a flesh wound, head to the screening at 6:30 p.m. Creeping a little bit into August, but still definitely worth a mention, and fitting in with our theme of 80s family movies, on Sunday the 3rd of August we have Princess Bride, the classic Rob Reiner film from 1986, which screens at 3 p.m. Why not bring the kids along? For more details about upcoming events, please head to www.christianfletcher.com.
Okay, in our last podcast we didn't really give you a lot of time to enter our Roger Rabbit competition. This time, however, we're definitely being a bit more generous with the time frame. Christian was mentioning earlier, Neverending Story is 30 years old this year, a fact that I find kind of scary. But we're not going to dwell on fear, no, instead, we're going to offer you the chance to win a double pass to this very special screening of this very special movie at the very special New Globe Theatre on the 16th of July. If you'd like to win these tickets, just leave the comment Falcor on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube, on the Podomatic page, or even if you want to put it in a review on iTunes. All the links are down below. Good luck! Thanks so much for listening to The Rufus Project. We hope you enjoyed the podcast as much as we enjoyed putting it all together. Please leave us your feedback, comments, or suggestions via Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, the Podomatic page, or leave us a review on iTunes. We're also keen to hear from anyone who would like to be featured or know someone who should be featured in our local wildlife section. If you don't want your comments quite so public, you can also send us an email at rufusreviews@gmail.com. So until next time, I couldn't think of anything witty to put as an ending, so feel free to add your own. See you next time. Stuff from the other week from our Attorney General and Graham Burke saying that Australians were the biggest pirates in the world, well, it doesn't take much digging to show that that is a completely false statement. But hey, why let the truth get in the way of sensationalism? The Rufus Project is getting close to the limits of its free hosting. To help us keep the previous episodes online and keep bringing you great content, we need your help.
If you're interested in helping the Rufus Project or have a product or service that would be of interest to us here at the podcast, please drop us an email at rufusreviews@gmail.com. Don't forget you can check out the podcast anytime, the recent episodes and previous ones at therufusproject.podomatic.com.
And while you're there, feel free to click on the donate button, and hopefully, if we can get enough help, those more generous of you might just get a little something extra from your generosity.
Ooh. Sorry, no doubt. And your help will ensure the Rufus Project keeps going, providing more of gaming reviews, movie reviews, local wildlife, and all your other favourite sections of the fortnightly podcast.